Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another fabulous episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, hosted by D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is going to be Doug Lyle with very special guest, David Corbett. So now, here's your host, Doug Lyle.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. Today, we're going to talk about private investigators. Who are these guys, and what do they do? David Corbett is a friend of mine. I've known him for a number of years, and we've turned over a few whiskey bottles together and taught some classes together, mainly up at Book Passage Writers Conference. And he's one of the most generous writers that I know, and gives of his time freely to other writers, both published and unpublished. And he's a gifted writer himself and also a wonderful teacher. He actually worked as a private investigator for some 15 years in the Bay Area, so he has some experience in that arena, both real life and fictional. His first book, The Devil's Redhead, was nominated for an Anthony and a Barry Award. His second, Done for a Dime, which I think is a fabulous title, was named a New York Times notable book and garnered a McCavity nomination. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. You know, they say the first private detective agency was apparently founded in 1833, though people argue about that, by a gentleman named Eugene Francois Vidal. And since then, to say that private investigators have had a colorful history doesn't exactly cover the subject, and all the way up to the famous Pinkertons, who were straddled both sides of the law, I think, most of their careers. Now, you've worked as a PI. What exactly does a private investigator do in the real world, and what do most people have the greatest misconceptions about what a private investigator does?
Well, first of all, when I was trying to scratch my head here about the, you know, when did the first private detective agency was, you know, when was it founded, and I sat there and I thought, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there weren't a lot of sheriffs or lawmen back in colonial America either. And the whole idea of the private operative, although he wasn't called a private detective, I mean, if your horses were stolen, you had to hire somebody to go and get them for you. And so the whole notion of the, you know, the guy for hire who enforces the law is as old as, well, certainly back colonial America, and I wouldn't be surprised if it goes back further than that. I'm not knowledgeable about that. But whenever you have a society that doesn't have the wherewithal to have lawmen who actually can enforce the law, and we all know that the Sheriff of Nottingham's job was not really to enforce the law.
you get people like Shane come along.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Shane or the whole idea of the individual, you know, who or Rooster Coburn in True Grit,
yeah,
is another good example. And this is very prominent in the plains and wherever you have, you know, limited law enforcement. Urban police departments, I don't think, showed up in America until the 1820s or 1830s, and they just showed up in the major cities. So there's always been that notion of that when the individual needs someone to basically, you know, pick up a club or a gun and try to obtain justice for the wronged individual, that's been around for a while, and is I would say quintessentially American. So we don't know the French anything. as far as the Pinkertons are concerned, that's an excellent example of guys who have given the profession a somewhat colored reputation. I mean, the Pinkertons were famous as strike breakers, but they also did legitimate stuff. They also, you know, worked as far as, you know, employee theft and worked in other ways with corporate America trying to hold up on the end of protecting the interests of their corporate clients, what law enforcement couldn't do. And that sort of gets to what, when your big question is, what exactly does a real PI do? And it's, again, kind of broad. The more you get the privatization of law enforcement, and this can be internal security in corporations, this can be the investigators for insurance companies, this can be a company like Kroll, which actually advertises itself as a private CIA. And then you have just the regular old private investigator who is essentially a individual for hire whose job is to find things out. And they can work for individuals, they can work for corporations, they can work for insurance companies, they very often work for lawyers. They very often work, when they do work for lawyers in the criminal justice system, work for defense lawyers, because prosecutors already have the police and their detectives, and the DA has detectives of their own to work on their behalf. And the private detective is the person who instead works for either private individuals or for criminal defendants. And in fact, when we were working in the 70s and 80s, Palladino and Sutherland, one of our clients referred to us as the people's pigs. it was a nickname that kind of stuck for a little bit. But talking about misconceptions, I think what a lot of people misconceive, because most people's acquaintance with PIs are in books, and one, you almost never carry a gun. First of all, because it's really not your job. My job was largely much more like a journalist than a police officer. I'm not there to maintain order. I am not there to enforce the law. I'm there to find things out. And when you come with a gun, you automatically are intimidating somebody, or you're afraid that something is going to happen. And what you have to do is say, look, my job is this. I need to get this person to talk to me. That's all I'm here to do. If they tell me to leave, I have to leave, or else that's harassment. And my job is to be persuasive enough, open enough, and persistent enough to get that interview. And basically, you find people, you talk to them, you write it up so the attorney can figure out what the witness said, and then your job is done until trial. And if witnesses are called, very often you're the liaison between the attorney and the witness. You sort of are the human face of the justice system. And I think that's really where a lot of the most rewarding work comes, because so many people feel so terrified of the justice system, and for good reason.
Do the police or district attorneys, prosecutors, did they ever hire outside
PIs,
really, or is that pretty rare?
For the most part, they don't, because they've got so many resources of their own. But that doesn't mean that we don't sometimes work in concert, especially, for example, the Menendez brothers trial was an example of where, and so in the Michael Jackson case, where we were working either for a private party whose interests coincided with those of law enforcement, or you worked in a Menendez brothers case, you worked for an insurance company. The company that was going to be paying out that, I forget what the lump sum was. It was definitely in the tens of millions. It might have been in the hundreds of millions. But they didn't want to pay that money. Understandably so. And they were more than willing to pay us to make sure that if there are any witnesses the police couldn't get to, that we got to them. If there were any leads that the police found difficult or perhaps unproductive, we made sure that that was the case and didn't just leave that to assumption. In the Michael Jackson case, in fact, this is kind of interesting, and it was in Marcia Clark's book about the O.J. Simpson trial. The Michael Jackson case started out with a guy named Howard Weitzman, defending Michael Jackson. And we knew Howard from the DeLorean case. We had worked with him. We actually had to sue him to get paid. So our relationships with Howard were quite frosty. One of the first things that Howard did was he hired some people who had worked for us to work for Michael and sent them out basically not just to not just to talk to witnesses, but to find out what we were telling witnesses, what witnesses were telling us. But something went awry when Johnny Cochran inherited this strategy and decided to use it a little bit more aggressively. He actually had these investigators going out and saying, listen, to ex-employees in particular, because their biggest threat was from ex-employees who no longer had an investment in the Jackson Empire. you know, that the people who still worked for Jackson were still very loyal to him for reasons which escape me. But in particular, his inner circle, I mean, they were very, very dependent on him financially, and they were actually using him rather badly. One of the biggest eye-opening things to me in that case was just what a bunch of predatory bloodsuckers were around Michael Jackson, basically telling him anything he wanted to hear and stealing him blind. But what they would do with the ex-employees, they Johnny Cochran sent these investigators out and said, basically, you know, look, Michael loves you. He cares about you. The door is always open if you want to come back. And the problem with that is that's right on the line of witness tampering.
Yep.
And Larry Klein, the plaintiff's counsel for Jordan Chandler, who was the first 14-year-old to sue, called Johnny up when he found this out. He said, boy, you know, I'd hate it. Because I know you, Johnny, and we've known each other for years here in Los Angeles. I'd hate it if one of those witnesses was wired. And Johnny Cochran says, I'll get back to you. Hung up. A couple hours later, there was a settlement on the table. And it was around the $20 million mark. And one of the conditions, which is illegal, is that the plaintiff would not testify before the criminal grand jury.
Hmm.
And this is
how do you enforce that?
Well, what you do is it's not written down. It's just the kid suddenly develops a very foggy memory and just
exactly
and doesn't remember anything. And he's doing that because he realizes his parents have impressed upon him that $20 million is $20 million. And but that was only one of the problems we had in that case. The other problem we had was that, like I said, we were working in concert with the police department. But the police were very hamstrung because they had to pass their potential witness lists up the chain of command, which would go to the DA's office and then come back. And Johnny Cochran still had a lot of connections in the DA's office. And he would just pick up the phone when he found out, you know, who we were talking to and called him and saying, look, this is a dead end. And the sergeant who was in charge of the admin side of seeing who was going to be interviewed and the paperwork and such was saying, you know, look, I send these lists up. And they come back down with names crossed out, and we never get an explanation. All of which really soured the relationship between the police and the district attorney's office. And that's why, in the O.J. Simpson case, they didn't go to the DA. They went directly to the grand jury. And I think a lot of what the tension and the screw-ups that happened in the O.J. Simpson case were very much dependent on and the product of this distrust between the LAPD and the DA's office. And we saw that firsthand when we were working on the Michael Jackson case.
Sure, I bet. And then it becomes a mishmash.
Well, yeah, you know, the cops aren't going to volunteer anything if they think that
sure.
they're going to be hung out to dry, or they're going to, which certainly happened to Mark Furman.
Exactly.
And,
you also worked on a couple of other famous cases. One of them was the Cotton Club murder.
Yeah,
People may not remember what that even was about.
I would be astonished. Well, it would be interesting to find out how many of your listeners actually do remember that thing, because it involved a guy named Ray Radden, I think his name was. Roy Radden, I think. It's a little bit vague. But he was a very minor operator. This is the kind of guy who did animal acts. If you ever saw the movie Broadway Danny Rose, he's the kind of guy who does parrots who play the xylophone, and women who do wine glasses and stuff. And he wasn't quite that cheap, but he was a minor player, and he wanted to be big time. And he somehow got the idea got in the inner circle of being part of a movie about the Cotton Club. The Cotton Club.
Right.
We ultimately did get made. And Robert Evans was involved, and his involvement in this whole murder was one of the seamier sides of the story. But there was a woman coke dealer who was one of the major sources of the funds for him on getting in this thing. And he became so persistent and such a problem that she ultimately arranged to have him taken out. And the people she chose for this charming task were guys who had been gym rats in L.A. and then hired by a guy named Bill Ryder, who was Larry Flint's chief of security. And Bill was a very interesting guy. And he had been a cop in Columbus, Ohio, my hometown, and I'm going to get into that in a little bit. But let's just say that Bill hired these guys, these steroid junkies, out of the gyms of L.A., would give them this primo job with the Larry Flint security team, would take a kickback. You know, that was part of the thing he insisted on. And then basically they had free reign. I mean, Bill was, I think Althea was a known junkie, and he would basically go out and get her heroin for her, and then he would beat up the junkie saying, if you ever tell anybody that you, you know, supplied to this woman, I'll kill you. And he meant it.
And he meant it.
And, yeah. I've never seen an individual intimidate witnesses to the extent that Bill Ryder did. And, again, we'll get to that, because there's an interesting tie. There's two cases that were tied together. And we were working a civil case, and that's how we got brought into the criminal case, the Cotton Club murder case. The civil case involved Bill Ryder, and he was suing Larry Flint for wrongful dismissal. He was fired because one day Flint's 14-year-old daughter came to Flint and said, by the way, I'm having consensual sex with Bill, and I just need you to know that. And Larry said, well, thank you, Bill. You're fired. And Flint, Ryder just said, it's a lie. Prove it. You know, you just gave me the act for no good reason. So he fired for wrongful dismissal, and which is a gutsy move, but Bill's a gutsy guy. And he'd been a police officer, like I said, in Columbus, Ohio. He knew what it was like to be on the stand. He wasn't afraid of any of this kind of stuff. So he was involved in this, and that's how we got brought in. Our job was basically to discredit Ryder, and by doing so, we might also be able to discredit him in a criminal case, because by this time, he'd also become the chief informant. A year after Radin's murder, and he was taken out into the desert in L.A. and murdered and just left there, and nobody knew what happened to him. There was a very peremptory police investigation, because nobody cared about this guy. And then it just kind of died away. But then Ryder, once he begins suing Larry Flint, you know, suffers this paranoid reaction, thinking that, you know, I know the kind of guys that work for Larry Flint because I hired them. And I know what Larry's going to do. Larry's going to have them come after me. Now, how can I protect myself? I can become the chief informant against the guys who took out Roy Radin. And I'll have an entourage of L.A. sheriff's deputies anywhere I go. And that's exactly what happened. He would walk into court with like six sheriffs, like there were snipers ready to take this guy out, which was kind of laughable, but that's the world he lived in. So our job now was to puncture some holes into his credibility. And when they found out that I was from Columbus, Ohio, they said, well, why don't you go back and see if you can find anything? And Columbus, Ohio was still, despite the fact it's now the largest city in Ohio, in many ways it's still a very small town. And I grew up with the son of the clerk of courts for Franklin County. And he was one of three of the top Republicans in the county at the time. And he was still clerk of courts when I went back to town. And he introduced me to some of the older cops who said, oh, yeah, we remember Bill. And in particular, you may want to find his ex-partner. We can't remember his name, but we know he got let go because of cocaine abuse. And I went, oh, that's interesting. I'll definitely want to track that down. In the meantime, I'm calling a buddy of mine who's a lawyer in town. I went to high school with him. And just, you know, saying, yeah, there's an interesting case here. And, you know, the guy I'm looking for is a guy named Bill Ryder. And I find out now that his partner apparently got taken down with cocaine charges. And my friend, there's a beat on the phone, and he goes, Mike McCandlish. That's how small a town it is. He gives me the witness's name on just that amount of information. I go, okay, great, boom. Where? How do I find him? I talked to the guy. He was relatively helpful, but the guys that were really helpful were the guys he'd worked with at the Columbus Police Department, who hated him. He'd been an undercover cop working narcotics, and he had burned other undercover cops so that he could make the scores and he could work his way up the ladder, and these guys would have to withdraw and wouldn't be able to make their busts. He also gave up the identities of snitches. And so they set him up once, you know, basically said, you know, they put in somebody else's file, a meet with a snitch at a certain place, knowing that Bill would jump on it and would go there first. And he did, and they sort of, you know, met him there and said, okay, now we know what you're doing. We've caught you in it. Boom, you're out of here. And he was fired for that. But what I also found out was that at one point he had sex with the 16-year-old daughter of one of his informants.
Mm-hmm.
And his come-on line was, gee, I'd hate to see your mom go to jail. That's
interesting.
Cold. That's
that is cold. Cold. That is cold.
And we ended up finding this woman, but his attorneys were very good at limiting her testimony. She could basically not tell her story, but only speak to his credibility. And, you know, the question was so convoluted, it basically got to, given the fact that when you were 16, you had consensual sex with Bill Ryder, would this in any way affect your willingness to believe him when he denied having sex with the 14-year-old daughter of Larry Flynt? And she simply said, yes, thank you. That's all she could testify to. And it wasn't enough. He ended up getting $6 million out of Larry Flynt.
Wow.
And there was a number of witnesses we spoke to that said, there's no way. That man is an animal, and I will not testify under any circumstances. And he put a bullet through the windshield of one of the attorneys in the civil case. I mean, we couldn't prove it. We don't know it was him. Let me qualify that.
Right,
but,
exactly.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Yes, indeed. So that was one of the most colorful individuals I ever ran across, for sure. And I remember I went to see his family in Columbus, and they were terrified. And you know me. I'm not a threatening guy. And of course, it can be scary when somebody shows up. And, you know, it's Columbus, Ohio. It's winter. It's dark. I ring the doorbell. I'm actually talking to the kid at the door. You know, he's like about 6 or 7. So, how are you doing? What's your name? The dog's there wagging its tail. And they're calling Bill, trying to figure out what to do. And they come to the door looking for my car so they can get the license number. Luckily, I had parked down the block so they couldn't see it. It was a rental anyway, so what? I mean, what's he going to get? My name? He's already got that. I just gave it to him. So, but his whole MO was that, no, they're out to kill me. So these people were terrified of me. And they were not terribly forthcoming. But we got the message to him saying, you know, we're not going to leave any rock unturned. We're going to, you know, we're going to find a story about you. And we also found two women, a woman who was a rental agent in an apartment that he rented. And he wanted his security deposit back when he left, and he'd pretty much trashed the place. And he said, no, we're not giving it to you. And he threatened to rape and kill the woman.
Nice guy.
So yeah, exactly. I can't imagine why the Columbus Police Department didn't want him. So anywho, so that was this is all around the Cotton Club murder case, which is all about, you know, he was the guy who hired the three or four guys, I can't remember, who took Roy Radin out into the desert and took him out. And he was the main informant in that case. So we worked that. I worked on the DeLorean case, but came in very late. But that was a case where we were brought in because we had worked a previous case involving the same two DEA agents and the same informant, who had pretty much done the same routine to a Lebanese businessman, which is, you know, acting as though the legitimate businessman, setting up a deal, a guy who's in distress, who's looking for quick capital. They come in saying, oh, we've got it for you. And then at one point, you know, finally let him know, by the way. And then he's in too deep, and if he tries to pull out, they say, look, it's too late for that. And the MO was usually that the informant would begin to threaten, but he wouldn't record this conversation. And I'm trying to remember what the snitch's name was in that, but he, I mean, even his own brother said, you know, I just wouldn't believe a thing that came out of his mouth. He had burned every single bridge in his life. And that's one of the things you find out. I mean, and cops will tell you this. There are some guys who just fundamentally, they'd rather make a dishonest nickel than an honest dollar.
Yeah, it's the game.
Yeah.
And that's the game, and more than the result.
They're smart enough. But they just can't do it. It's just not in their nature. So,
well, the other case you worked on that, you know, that's always fascinated me for on so many levels is People's Temple, the Jim Jones and Jonestown and all that stuff. Well, what was your involvement with Reverend Jones and his bailu?
We came in because the case was a murder case, essentially. You know, the murder of Representative Ryan, but
right.
There's no jurisdiction in the United States.
Right.
The only thing that we could prosecute...
But it was down in Ghana.
It was down in Ghana, in Guyana.
Ghana, yeah.
And, but there is a federal statute against the plot to endanger the life or assassinate a U.S. representative. And so that's what he was being charged with. The only surviving member of the temple who had been part of the party that went to the airstrip and began firing was a guy named Larry Layton. And he was the brother of Carolyn Layton, who was very high in the temple and very close to James Jones. But Larry was always something of a dweeb and something of a shadow figure. You know, not very self-assertive, very low self-esteem, always wanted to be part of the inner circle, but had, you know, never really earned his way into that sense of closeness with Jones himself. So this was, in a certain sense, probably his way to do that. Now, we're working on his defense, and what everybody we talked to, even the families of victims, told us was that you have to tell the story of what happened inside the temple. You know, they think everybody's crazy, but they weren't. They were deprived, they were brainwashed, they were isolated, they were starved to death, and they were lied to repeatedly by Jones. And which became all the more easy to do when you've got them in the middle of jungle. And a lot of these, you know, it was the 70s where everybody was, you know, looking for some kind of wonderful community that would escape all the problems of the terrible bourgeois capitalist society of America and imperialist and blah, blah, blah. And it ends up that there's one of the founding members of the families of the People's Temple, which were the people who had left and were trying to get their family members out, comes from Columbus, Ohio, my hometown. It's amazing how we keep on coming back to Columbus. I figure so much.
A hotbed of crime.
And I met him by accident at a party here in San Francisco, and we've become pretty good friends. And what we found out when I was only in the second trial. The first trial ended in a hung jury. And so the federal government decided to retry. And I came on because I was working for the firm at that time, and the woman who had been one of the lead investigators had gone off to form her own company. Her name was Melody Ermachild, and Melody is one of the best investigators I've ever worked with, a truly committed, smart, compassionate, and just wonderfully ethical. I just really admire Melody. And so she gave me sort of my entree into a number of the witnesses. We split them down the middle. I took some, she took the others. And we're just trying to reconnect with them. And these are people who, if they ever let anyone know they'd been in the People's Temple, they'd be shunned, they might lose their jobs. So this was a secret they were really trying desperately to keep so they could just try to get their lives back together. And so many of them didn't want to, they certainly didn't want to testify. They didn't want to be identified as former members of the People's Temple. But they didn't want to hang Larry out to dry either, because they knew, you know, that he was just, you know, a couple inches beyond where they had been. Some had gotten out. There was one woman I really admire. She'd been in Guyana, and she saw what was happening, and she strapped her kid into a knapsack and took off into the jungle and found the railroad tracks and said, well, I don't know which way it is to Georgetown, but she had to pick one direction, and she chose correctly, thank God. But otherwise...
Any port in the storm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she just knew, you know, I mean, these train tracks lead from somewhere to somewhere.
Yeah.
We're
going to take
right
a brief break here, Dave, and we'll come back and pick up that thought as soon as we come back on the backside.
That sounds great.
Yep. We'll be right back.
everybody, back here to Crime and Science Radio after the break. And here now again is your host, Doug Lyle.
Well, welcome back, everybody. I'm here talking with the wonderful David Corbett, Diamond Dave, XPI and great author. Let me ask you this. You know, you've had a pretty broad career and been involved in a lot of things that we talked about. You know, and you see on television and you see in the news even, what's the true, typical relationship between a private investigator and the police? Do they ever scratch each other's back, or are they always adversarial, or is it more like just detente? They know each other exists and try to screw each other over all the time, or is there any common ground?
The common ground comes when, like the cases I mentioned before, the Menendez trial or the first Michael Jackson case, where we were either working a civil case with interests parallel to the police. For example, we're representing the plaintiff in the case we're working on is the victim of the crime, and there's a civil action which will be a tort, some kind of abuse sort of thing, and the police are prosecuting it from the criminal end. We therefore have very similar purposes. We're trying to make either the criminal defendant or the civil defendant pay for what they've done. Or in the case of an insurance case like the Menendez brothers, we're trying to protect our clients' interests, the insurance companies, by helping prove that there are reasons why, however the death came about, they violate the conditions for a legitimate payout on the policy. In other words, you're not allowed to kill your parents and collect. That's a fundamental rule.
Right.
And that was pretty well proven. However, you know, it's funny. When I worked as a PI, I didn't know many cops. We were pretty much adversarial. We didn't talk very often. Detente's not a bad word. I mean, we're at war, but we're not bombing each other. We're not going to help each other. This is a great joke. I'm trying to remember. A friend of mine said that he was with two cops in a car once, and he was doing a drive-along. And he mentioned something about, you know, I've got a friend who's a PI, and one cop turned to the other. He says, let me see, when was the last time a PI solved a case? Never. And it's true. PIs aren't there to solve cases. We're there to basically test the evidence. The prosecution has to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. We're there to try to show that they can't. They haven't met that burden, which usually goes either to making the police look like they've done the investigation inadequately or even corruptly, or the informant lacks any credibility whatsoever. And that usually is your major thrust. If there's an informant in the case, and this is very true of drug cases, we sort of called ourselves snitch busters, that the informant often was one of the most unlikable players in the drama. He's the weasel. He's the Judas.
Right.
And Tony Serra, the great defense attorney from San Francisco, said, look, the first rule of all criminal defense is snitches lie. You've got to prove that. I've got to use that. It's our key, you know, to representing the client. So that's pretty much what, you know, you focus on the informant's credibility. You find out where in their testimony they've said things that are demonstrably untrue, and you prove that. You nail that down. And so when that comes up, the attorney can use that under cross-examination to point out the fact that, okay, the snitch has lied about this. The snitch has lied about this. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, he's lied about that and that and that. Why are you believing the rest of it? If it's not corroborated by somebody else, we just think you should disregard all of it, because there's one thing we've proved. This man lies. And so that's basically, you know, how you work. Well, the police's relationship with the informant is much different. They don't think he's a saint by any means, but, you know, one, they need him to prove the case, and two, very often there is a much more personal relationship between, you know, a cop and his informant. So it gets testy.
And I bet often the informants will tell them what they want to hear because they want the $50 or whatever, you know. Sure.
Or the 500, the 5 million.
Yeah, whatever it is,
you know,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
let me ask you this. The police obviously are handcuffed by that little thing called the Fourth Amendment. And so they have to get, like, warrants and stuff like that. What kind of restrictions do private investigators have that are less restrictions that might allow them to do more, or even more to the point, as you read in fiction, amateur sleuths, who, of course, have no license, no badge, no gun, you know, and can do what the heck they want. How does all that work together, and what could you do as a PI that was more clever than what the police could do, and then what could an amateur sleuth do that's more clever, so to speak, than you could do?
To be honest with you, I don't know. We always felt hamstrung. We felt that we had nowhere near the resources or the capabilities of the police. You know, because basically a magistrate, you've got to really work hard to get a magistrate to turn down your warrant. I mean, you've either got to just write that thing like a six-year-old,
right,
or you've got to really be reaching for something you don't have a right to anyway. You're going to be able, for the most part, to get those things you want, but you do have to spell them out. You can't just go in and take them. We're almost always, you know, behind the fact. And we also are very much beholden to privacy issues. We can't go and take somebody's property. The closest thing that ever came up for me with this, we were working for a corporation that shall remain nameless, but they were in the business of helping people send money overseas, especially, but basically just they were you know, a major player in the whole transmission of money, so relatives could send each other money and that sort of thing. But they were going to begin closing out the operations that were sort of the mom and pop, you know, street front. They wanted to do it more in terms of the larger banks, and they were closing out the sort of the lower end of the business. And they were going to franchise that out. Well, a couple of the area managers in Southern California began to self-deal and create their own franchises and take these things over as inside players and worked the system very much to their advantage. And this was very much against the policy of the company. This was grounds for termination and more. And so our job was to figure out how they were doing it. And I went down to, I think, Riverside, that beautiful Southern California metropolis. And I went to one of the operations that had previously been with the company and now was independent. And one of the manager there had worked under both regimes and had worked with the nephew of one of the targets of our investigation, and he had been the manager for a while. And when I spoke to her, she said, well, you know, he was always on the phone with these guys, and, you know, they had code words, and I said, they had code words? They said, oh, they all had names, like Big Dog and Salty Dave or something. And I said, really? She says, yeah, and the guy she worked with, the younger guy, the son, said he could never remember them, so he always wrote it down on their Rolodex cards. I said, he did what? I said, you still have these Rolodex cards? She goes, yeah, I think so. And she goes over, and she's got them there. And I'm going, do you need these anymore? She goes, no. I said, would you mind if I had them? Now, I don't have a warrant, you know, but I haven't paid her anything. I haven't bribed her. But we were working for a very prominent, very conservative San Francisco law firm. They'd never used this before. And so I got these things. And what you do is on the back of the card, you circle, you put the date and your initials inside a circle so that you can verify, I got these on these dates. This is who, you know, and I'm sort of part of the chain of evidence. And I write up my report that I got them from this person and so on and so forth. I got a statement from her that she gave them to me. We're all good. However, we hadn't printed up the report or the statement before we presented counsel, because we were really proud of ourselves. You know, look what we got.
Look,
I mean,
what
this,
we found,
a smoking,
yeah,
gun. I just gave it to you. And so we gave it to counsel, and they just looked terrified. And I remember the lead counsel looked at me and said, how did you get this? And I said, I asked for it. And he just, you could just see the relief, you know, like the blood come back to his face. Like, I don't know what he thought I had done, you know, either like break into some place. Because, of course, they're always worried.
That brings up Another question, I mean, you read in books and you see on television programs and movies and stuff that private investigators do all kinds of things. They plant tracking devices. They dig into people's bank accounts. They tap their cell phones. They actually break and enter and go snoop around.
Well, yeah, a guy like Anthony Pelicano, who we called Thug to the Stars,
were you ever aware of people actually doing that kind of stuff, or is that more fiction?
No. I mean, there are guys who do that. But, again, that is against the law. That's why Pelicano was in jail.
Right.
And my boss was Jack Palladino, and people would confuse the two names because they're similar.
Sure.
And nothing drove Jack crazier than being confused with Anthony Pelicano because he just hated the guy. I mean, he just made all of us look slimy and stupid. But, you know, no, I mean, there was this whole chain of evidence thing. If you're actually going to use this in a courtroom, you've got to prove to the court that you got it by legitimate means.
Right. Like asking for it.
Yes.
Well, what's the diciest situation you ever found yourself in? Was there ever a situation you got into where you were doing one of these investigations and going out and interviewing people and whatnot where you thought, you know, I might not see tomorrow morning? Did you ever get in a situation
that
you were really worried?
Before I get there, I'm going to do one more story on the sort of the gray of the law, because I know that you also wanted to ask me, did I ever bend the rules?
Right.
And one rule, and this came up with the Linda Tripp situation with the blue dress and Monica Lewinsky, and because she tape recorded her conversations with Monica Lewinsky, and did so without Monica's knowledge or consent. And in Maryland, that's a crime. In California, it is also a crime. You're not allowed to record without the subject's knowledge or consent as an investigator unless you have reason to believe that the witness might try to extort you or might threaten you with violence or claim that you threatened them with violence. Now, that seems like a little door, but it can be as big a door as you want it to be.
Sure.
And what we would often do is we would just run the recorder, because sometimes it would be like 3 weeks before you'd finally sit down to write a report. And I remember once remembering a witness's testimony one way. When I played back the recording, I found out I had it exactly wrong, and that was sobering. So we would always record. However, it's only admissible as evidence in the event that the witness did threaten you physically, claim you threatened them, or claim that you tried to extort them. Even if they confessed to something on that tape, if it doesn't involve those three things, it's inadmissible.
So you can record it, you just can't share it unless it fits those criteria.
It's a gray line. You can get into trouble for the recording alone. However, if you walk into a judge's chambers with counsel and say, we have this tape recording, he may yell and scream, but he's also going to yell and scream at the other side for not bringing this up.
Sure.
So it's one of those things where you do it even though you're pushing the law, because you never know what's going to happen in that interview. You never know what's going to be said. And you're dealing with very questionable people. So to protect yourself and in some ways, just a bookkeeping device. I mean, just, you know, I said, maybe 3 weeks, maybe 6 weeks before you get back to that, you know, you sit there and just go, now, what did this guy tell me again? But then you just get rid of it. You know, if there's nothing on it beyond that, then it's worthless.
Who's your favorite fictional private investigator?
I'm
going
to get
special.
Back to the diciest situation. Cause that's and I have a great answer for
you. I definitely want to hear that.
I only was in – what's interesting, and this is how being a PI is so different than being a police officer and why cops really do deserve a lot of our respect, because they face these things every day. Only once in 15 years was I in physical danger, and it was a doctor, who tried to kill me.
Really?
And it was in a federal drug case.
It wasn't me. I want us to get clear
on
that.
Yeah, no, it wasn't you. It was a federal drug case, and again, we were working to impeach the informant, and he had reached a deal with the government, and supposedly had come clean about all his criminal dealings. Well, we knew some of his criminal dealings and knew that he had deliberately omitted the name of one of his major lieutenants for a period because he didn't want him involved in this whole thing because he had cleaned up his act and he'd become a doctor. So we were looking for this guy. And we ended up finding him in Hannibal, Missouri, of all places. But back in the day, he had been a driver for this cocaine ring that had been connected to the Medellin cartel. He had basically, you know, they'd pick up the drugs would be delivered to Miami. And he would drive them across country. That's back in the old days, that's how cocaine reached California.
Hey, they don't call it the Sunshine State Parkway for nothing.
Yeah. You know how many of these guys got arrested in New Mexico because New Mexico has a zero tolerance for speeding? It's astonishing. I mean, New Mexico probably played a bigger part in the cartel's desire to get some kind of way to get cocaine into America that didn't involve driving across the United States. Anyway, so he was a driver. But now he was, you know, he'd done it for a year and they decided, no, I want to get out. You know, I can, if I want to peddle drugs, I can do it legitimately with my, you know, my MD. So I'm out. And Alion Anderson was the name of the trafficker. And he said, fine, I'll let you go. And but we knew how important he was because he was tangible evidence that Alion Anderson had lied to the federal government in his plea deal. So we wanted to find him. And I went to Hannibal, Missouri, you know, tried to find him. You know, I knew his house. I went, he wasn't there. Talked to his wife, met the dog. Dog was a Dalmatian. The one creature that was happy to see me was that dog. Every time I showed up at that house, the dog's tail was wagging. And it was nice to at least have that. But I went to see his dad, and he was a character. He was a shady guy himself. And everybody was getting pissed at me, and I wasn't getting the guy. And then that same weekend, I found out that my brother was dying of AIDS. And I was just, by Monday, I was so pissed off at the world, at fate, at this guy, at myself. I said, I'm getting him one way or another. I'd even gone to his clinic and pretended to have an ailment to see if he would treat me so I could just talk to him. So what I did is I waited outside his clinic. I had my tape recorder, because you use a tape recorder during subpoena service because people claim all sorts of things. You know, you pulled a gun on him, you did all sorts of stuff. You threaten them. So you run your tape recorder to protect yourself from that. You bring a camera in case they run so you can take pictures of them fleeing. So I had my camera and my tape recorder. I'm hunched down in the car. And I'd scoped it out, and I realized that if he goes behind his clinic, the parking lot was weird. There was these very steep culverts dividing it. So if he went back there, there was no way for him to get out except back the way he came, which is this one-lane little access lane on the side of the clinic. So I see him go back. I know I've got him cornered. I walk back, and I turn the corner just as he's getting out of his car. He sees me, jumps back into the car, puts it in gear and starts coming toward me. And like I said, I was just angry. I wasn't trying to be brave. I wasn't valiant. I wasn't trying to be virtuous. I was just ticked off. And I just stood there. And I just said, okay, you want to have at it. And luckily, at the last minute, the Hippocratic Oath kicked in. And he stops right in front of me. And my tape recorder is going. The only sound on my tape recorder is him revving his engine trying to scare me. As I lean over his hood, pick up the windshield wiper, put the subpoena under it, and set it back down again. Because that, when you do that, that's a legitimate service. I then stepped aside. He took off. I called him about an hour later, you know, trying to get through to him to say, look, just talk to me. We can withdraw the subpoena if you're willing to give us an interview. But you've got to talk to us. And he refused. And but that was it. That was the only time I was ever in danger.
Wow.
And some of that was my own stupidity.
And anger.
Yeah. Very much anger.
Cool. Well, now let's talk about the fictional guy.
Guy.
Who's your favorite PI in fiction and why?
Well, you know, there's my favorite and there's the one whenever anybody asks me, well, you know, does anybody get it right? I said, oddly enough, you know what the most accurate portrayal of a PI I've ever seen is? Is Paul Drake on Perry Mason.
Huh.
That is what a PI does. You know, he works with a lawyer, he goes out and gets the evidence.
And he always did.
Secretary.
Yeah. And flirts with the secretary, of course.
So he's my favorite just from accuracy standpoint. But probably I sort of resisted the whole PI thing, but the one writer I just loved was James Crumley. And I'm trying to I could remember his name. I was trying to remember his PI's names. There's Shugru, and there's And I just it's a long Polish name, and it's escaping me right now. And but I talked. Hold on here. I will get it. I'm here in my office. I can Milo Dragovich. That was his name.
Okay.
And I just liked him because he was so damn funny.
And the author is Crumley.
James Crumley. Oh, yeah. Dennis Lehane once said that James Crumley probably had more to do with more guys wanting to write crime fiction than anybody he knew. And in the book Books to Die For, which is a wonderful compilation, it's like 70 crime writers, list the book that made them want to write crime. And Lehane chose The Last Good Kiss, which is also by Crumley, and I chose The Wrong Case. And they're just he was just a spectacular writer. And there was something about his PI, Milo, who's just his heart is not always in the right place. I mean, he's kind of a lecherous drunk, to be honest with you. But the writing is so grand. And in the end, he really does have a very definite moral center that you can't help but root for him and want him to prevail. And although he's very often mistaken in some key way, usually because he's too willing to believe in the innocence of the people who hire him. So he's probably my favorite in the PI world.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro for everybody out there, you know, Dave is a great teacher of fiction writing, and you need to go up to Book Passage sometime and go to that crime writing conference over there, the mystery writing conferences, and hear some of his classes. They're just great, and he teaches other places too and even has some online classes. But I would be remiss without mentioning your wonderful book, The Art of Character, and I couldn't recommend this more. Every writer in any genre, not just crime fiction, any genre should read this book. It will give you a multi-layered view of how to develop characters that are real, that live and breathe and bleed and sweat and grunt and do all the things you want your characters to do rather than just lay there on the page. If you took the two or three bullet points that you would want every writer to know about developing character that you discussed in The Art of Character briefly, I realize you can't. You could talk about this for hours, I know. What would be the two or three things that you think are absolutely essential in creating a believable and realistic character?
The first thing is to realize that, as we all know, you need to know what the character wants, but you also need to know that in many ways characters are unaware of their deepest want. I call that the yearning. And the tension between the outer desire, which is usually the desire line is the outer objective, you know, to save the hostage, to catch the killer, to rescue the kidnapped victim. But underneath is the yearning. What is it within the character that makes that absolutely necessary? Why can they not accept failure? Because they're going to be facing failure. If you're doing your book right, if the conflict is intense enough, if the adversaries are truly at war the way they should be, especially in a crime novel, what is it that makes him continue at that crucial moment in the story when it just everything looks bleak and he's in his darkest hour? Why can't he give it up? And if you need to understand that as well as just, you know, why does he... It's not just, you know, that he wants to serve justice. There's something implicit to him and in his nature that makes it necessary for him to continue, that makes him makes it necessary for him to do everything in his power to prevail.
Because failure is not an option.
The second thing is the two things that I always find fascinating, and they sort of are like to create contrast and depth, you know, the little buttons on the old TVs. I'm dating myself, but
mm-hmm.
And secrets create depth. If you give your character a secret, in particular something that he's terrified that if it was ever disclosed, I mean his status among other people would change forever, you automatically create an inside and an outside. You automatically create that illusion of depth. For contrast, you want contradiction. Most people are wildly, slyly contradictory. And once you understand that, that people can be both one thing and the other, people are automatically drawn to the thing that holds those two opposites together.
The shadow side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dave, it has been absolutely wonderful having you here, and we'll do this again down the road. And I want to remind the listeners that, remember, go to the website, and both mine and Jan Burke's and, of course, John's at Crime and Science Radio. You will find all kinds of links, including links to David's website, so you can see all his wonderful books. Buy them and read them. You will be greatly rewarded. So until next time, this is going to sign off this edition of Crime and Science Radio. Hope we see all of you next time. And again, Dave, thanks so much.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me here.